Coming up on Philosophy Talk,
work.
I'm sick and tired of you lying around the house doing nothing but eating and sleeping all day.
And that goes for you too, you weasel-faced porcupine.
Now, wait a minute, honey. We'll go out and get this job even if it kills us. Come on, fellas.
Well, don't you know?
That's the sound of the men working on the chain. Gang.
There's nothing more you'll do with your life than work. You will not sleep as much, eat as much, recreate with your friends, spend time with your family as you will work.
Our guest, Al Gini, author of My Job, Myself.
The reason we don't reflect upon it and talk about it is because most of us don't like it.
Well, don't you know
that's the sound of the men working on the chain. Gang, all day long they're saying.
That goes for all of you, you sleeping hyenas.
What is work?
Recorded before a live audience at Centenary College in Shreveport, Louisiana.
Work, coming up on Philosophy Talk.
After the news.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today, we've taken Philosophy Talk on the road. We're recording the program in front of a live audience at Centenary College in Shreveport, Louisiana.
Where Ken and I have been Attaway Fellows for the last week, but our thinking originated at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
We're very pleased to meet in person some of our listeners and fellow philosophers here in Shreveport. Folks, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Our topic today is work. Work in the sense in which humans work. They have jobs. They go to work. They love their work or they hate their work. Some humans work to live. Others live to work. Some are workaholics. What's philosophy got to do with work, Ken?
Well, John, a person's work is related to a person's life and their sense of self, their identity. Work plays a huge role in making life meaningful or, if it's drudgery, meaningless. But first, there are a couple of ambiguities we ought to straighten out.
Yeah, like what?
Well, first, there's a process-product distinction. Process-product ambiguity. For example, a sculptor's work is to sculpt. That's a process, something the sculptor does. But the work he does creates a sculpture, a statue. That's the product, the result of the work.
So a sculptor might make a statue in order to have a statue, or he might just enjoy making statues and throw them away once he makes them.
Right, and when I ask you, John Perry, say, John, do you love your work? And if you say yes, it might be because you enjoy writing all those books you've written. You might think, I don't think so, but you might think that the books themselves are pretty lousy. Or maybe you hated writing the books, but think that the books, the works, the result of all that hard labor are just magnificent.
Well, you're right. I love all my books. I like the look of them on the shelf. And when I take them down from the shelf and read them and reread them, they always seem so plausible. You know, there's really no one I agree with as much as myself. But I suppose most of us, if we say we like our work, don't mean we like the product of our work, but we like doing the thing we get paid to do. And I suppose liking your job is a very nice thing. I like my job, and I'm glad I do. But it's not quite the same as what you're talking about. It's being part of my identity. What did you mean by that?
Well, I mean, work really is part of you, part of yourself. I mean, so there's certain descriptions of ourselves, certain ways of identifying ourselves that we regard as, like, very, very important. I mean, most males, for example, think it's really important to be a male, and they couldn't imagine being a female and not being the same person that they were. And maybe some Southerners can't imagine being from the North without, like, changing who they are. And some people, in that same way, identify themselves with their job or their profession.
I guess like the three most expensive words in the English language are probably as a doctor. You know, you hear that, you know it's going to cost you some money. As a lawyer is almost as bad. But those words don't just tell you that what this guy does for a living. They tell you how this person conceives of themselves, how they think, how they experience things. And I guess that's what you're getting
at. Yeah, that is what I'm getting at. Being a lawyer or a doctor for somebody like that is part of their identity, part of their self-conceptions. Now, some lawyers probably, and some doctors, and maybe even some philosophers, wear their jobs more lightly I mean, for some doctors or lawyers, maybe the fact that they're a golfer or a bass fisherman is more important to who they are.
Well, I suppose. What about the concept of a calling or a vocation? Isn't that the same idea?
Yeah, it's a similar idea, but that comes from religion. God calls on some people to serve him. But, you know, it gets used outside of religion, too, not just for ministers or monks or nuns. But there's some people who feel like their work calls to them. The person had to be a writer, had to be an artist or a philosopher, and they couldn't have been anything else, at least not, and be happy.
Isn't this all kind of dangerous? Isn't a person who's that wrapped up in what they do likely to miss out on life's other pleasures?
Well, maybe, but you know what? Let's find out how everyday people feel about the kinds of things they do. Our roving philosophical reporter, Zoe Cornelie, files this report.
I'm here at a local shopping center. Some of the people I see are working right now. Others just got done with work. Some of these people do things that might not normally be considered work.
I haven't really had a regular job since 1973. John Osterhaug is the name. I have my own handcraft jewelry business. I make and sell jewelry made of glass. Staying at home and making stuff, that's the part I like. I can work as much as I want, depending on paying the bills. So to pay all the bills, I have to work all the time. But I'm getting by okay. I'm actually buying food here at Trader Joe's. I have to look for the bargains, but, you know, at least I'm eating well.
My name is Muni Elkindi, and I work at Trader Joe's. Everything from stocking food to spoiling food to grabbing cards, bagging, checking groceries out. I view this as a stepping stone in what I want to do, because I don't accept this as my future, and that's my career.
Hi, my name is Michelle Londoño. I actually retired from the workforce 2 years ago to stay home full-time with both my children. I was working and I had returned to work when I had my children, especially my first. I was still working close to full-time, and I knew that was just not going to work for my family, that I needed to be there more for my children, even though with the second child, I was there part-time. It was a bit tough because I did enjoy my work. The identity does shift, and it's once people say, are you working? And it's always hard to respond to how to respond to that question. I saw myself as a public health nurse. I still do see myself as a public health nurse, even though I am a full-time mom.
My name is Clayton Brown. I'm a recent graduate of the Stanford Business School, and in between school and work at the moment, working on some entrepreneurial projects. I think that work should be an end in itself, and if you're doing something that really involves your own creativity and your own vision, then you can really start to feel engaged in it and passionate about it. And I think that that's the great thing about entrepreneurship, if you can pull it off, which remains to be seen in my case.
My name is Phil Grantham, and I do pharmaceutical sales. Currently, right now, I'm selling respiratory drugs for asthma and COPD. It's what I do, but it's not who I am. I mean, you know, sometimes I'll talk to someone for half an hour, and I'll go tell someone else, I met this great person, you know, what do they do? And sometimes I go, well, I never even asked them. I would hope that more people would think like that, you know, because, you know, work is important, and there's a lot of people doing a lot of hard work. But, you know, if you don't take time for the small things and family and stuff, then, you know, what is it all for?
My name's Juan Trujillo, and I'm a sales associate for Bed Bath & Beyond. Actually, today's my first day, so I'll be working registers and mainly focusing on customers. Well, I've been off of work for almost a year. I've done side jobs to keep me, you know, afloat, but yes, I've been looking for a steady job. I have 5 kids of my own and one for my girlfriend, so I'm very excited to start working again.
Well, it's been nice talking to you all, but I've really got to get back to work. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Zoe Cornelie.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk, coming to you from Centenary College in Shreveport, Louisiana. I'm John Perry, and along with me is Ken Taylor.
And we're joined now by Al Genie. He's professor of business ethics in the School of Business Administration at Loyola University, Chicago. He's also the resident philosopher at Chicago Public Radio, and he's author of My Job, Myself, Work, and the Creation of the Modern Individual. Al, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Glad to be here. Glad to be here.
Al, like most of us, I'm sure you've worked all of your life, but how did you become interested in the philosophy of work?
Well, somewhere along about the 20th year of my life, we have mileposts in our lives, I think. I was about 40. I was going through my first midlife crisis, which was then followed by my second and third and fourth midlife crisis. But the first midlife crisis was about, do I really want to do this? I was loving what I was doing. I wasn't making a lot of money. I had children who insisted on eating every single day and requiring clothes. So I was really concerned about that, and I was thinking about changing my life. I couldn't find another job because I was radically undertrained.
You couldn't find other less demanding children.
That's right. That's right. Should have done that.
Yeah. And so you couldn't starve them to death.
Yeah, yeah. So I wanted to look at work, this thing that sits in the middle of our lives and we don't talk about, this 800-pound gorilla that all of us do, but few of us reflect upon it. And one of the first things I found in my research is the reason we don't reflect upon it and talk about it is because most of us don't like it.
We don't like our work.
No, I think statistics in the last 25 years are suggesting they've gotten a little better, but better than half of the workforce says they're not happy with their jobs. I don't mean a little discontent. On any given day, we don't like our parents, we don't like our loved ones, we don't like our children. No, that's every day. Okay, I'll come back to that another time. But I think that in point of fact, most people are dissatisfied with their job. They like the money, they like the perks, but they don't like the task itself.
Well, let's jump to the bottom line and get some wisdom from you, then we'll work back to the details. Okay. Work provides money, and it can provide meaning.
Well, it can provide
meaning. How do you make it so you get both out of it?
Yeah. Well, sometimes you have to trade off. And I think that the statistics are showing that people will trade meaning for money. Those who go into acting, for example, I have a roommate who's still hoping to break into show business. And every time I go to New York and see him as he serves me lunch, I ask him, what's he doing? And he says, I'll wait for that. He serves me lunch. He says, I'm an actor. And he's not quite an actor. But I do think that what we want in life is both meaning and money.
Well, that is an important thing. If you listen to a roving philosophical reporter's piece, I was struck by the woman who said she's staying at home with her children right. and full-time, but she still thinks of herself
yeah.
as whatever kind of nurse she was.
Right.
Right. So even though she wasn't doing it, she wasn't getting any paid for it, it was part of the meaning of her life
right.
to be that thing. And then the other fellow, the next fellow up, said, well, I don't really think of myself in terms of
right.
my work. I want to stop thinking of myself that way. I think of all the other things in my life.
Right. He said, "I, what I do is not what I want to do." But I think if you translate that, it says, I do not want to do what I want to do, and I don't want to be what this job would make me. I want to be something larger. I want to be something bigger. Studs Terkel said, the major problem with work in most of our lives, it's not big enough for us as persons. It doesn't touch us in different ways. To use E.F. Schumacher, it doesn't give us beauty. It doesn't give us joy.
Now, is that a criticism of the way we work, of work itself? If work were ideal work, would it? Should we strive to so arrange our work lives and ourselves so that, you know, work does, or in an ideal world, you'd say, well, there's your work over there, and there's yourself over there.
Well, I don't think we make that dichotomy because we put in too many hours in the job to begin with. If, you know, as adults, I tell this to my undergraduates, there's nothing more you'll do with your life than work. You will not sleep as much, eat as much, recreate with your friends, spend time with your family as you will work. And I point out that these are the great years. You know, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday starts at 10:30. Tuesday, you don't even make, and Thursday
You're
is
talking
an
about
option.
University yeah, life. Yeah, yeah these yeah. students out there.
Right, right, I understand. But I think that in reality, most of us are not happy with our job, and I think the problem is twofold. The structure and nature of jobs themselves and the hours we have to put in on those jobs. I think those are connected but separate problems.
So you think that the three of us, we're all basically make a living doing, I guess, what we enjoy,
right.
thinking about philosophy,
right.
teaching, and so forth and so on. Do you think it's conceivable that everybody could have a job they enjoy, or do we somehow need to deal with the fact that that's not possible?
I don't think every job is a joy, but every person can find a job. I think it's possible for more people than presently to find a job to which they're suited and can understand. My grandfather once said to me, the only job you start at the top is digging a ditch. And wait, I'll wait for that one again, right?
Yeah, boom, boom.
But the reality is some people are very content in digging a ditch. But if you really have the talent to be a brain surgeon, digging a ditch is never going to do it for you.
I mean, some people are content at digging a ditch. Digging a ditch can be pretty back-breaking work. I'm not sure how many people would be fully fulfilled when digging a ditch.
I didn't say fully fulfilled. But I said find some meaning in doing it.
Well, nowadays, when you dig a ditch, you have one of these backhoes, and frankly, I think that looks like a lot of fun.
We'll follow up on that thought in a bit. This is a special edition of Philosophy Talk, coming to you from Centenary College in Shreveport, Louisiana. We're talking about work with our guest, Al Genie.
Yeah, easy for you to say. We've been talking about what work is and under what conditions it becomes meaningful or meaningless. Next, we're going to talk about how work connects with identity. Should the answer to the question, what do you do, really be your job? How much of a person's identity can or even should derive from their work?
Work and the self, along with questions from you, our live studio audience, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Do you work for a living or do you live for working? Is your job an important part of who you are or just a way to get money for the weekends when the real you lets loose? I'm the party animal, John Perry.
And I'm the workaholic, Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk and we're discussing work. Our guest is Al Genie from Loyola University Chicago.
Is it a good thing to identify what you do and what you are with what you do for a living and what your job is? Or is it a sad thing, a bad thing? If technology brought us to a place where no one really had to work more than an hour or two a week, would we all be better off?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, Al, let's think about this question of work and identity.
Yes.
I mean, from the stuff you were saying in the last segment, it sounds to me like you think some jobs may be worth having as a part of your identity, identifying with, and some jobs may not be worth it. How do you decide that balance?
First of all, there's a difference between good jobs and bad jobs. I mean, there are jobs which people really want that impart meaning. I mean, there's a difference between a brain surgeon and digging that ditch, and we have to accept that. What I was talking about is people who do the work, there are people in different strata, but I think that one of the real issues is whether you like your job or hate your job. Given the hours we put in a job, it is imprints on us something. It affects us in a real way, and it changes how we look at the world, see the world, and understand the language of the world and others.
Are you suggesting that your work is a part of who you are, whether or not you like it?
Whether
it forces itself, the work, as it were, forces itself into yourself.
Absolutely force yourself into it. And I talk about different categories of working. For example, police. Joseph Wambach, in perhaps his worst book, The Choir Boys, talks about cops see people at their worst and the worst kind of people. Therefore, the internal portrait of a lot of police is this kind of adversarial relationship with others. Always somebody's always the bad guy. MDs, nurses, people in the medical profession always see the world as a malady that has to be cured and afraid of that kind of thing. So I think all of us, we see the world through what we've read and what our friends have read.
But we see the world as a bunch of confused people.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Who need our help?
Wanting their grades changed.
And wanting their grades changed, exactly so.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're at Centenary College talking about work with Al Genie. We'd like questions from our live studio audience. What do you think about work? Do you identify with your work? Do you disidentify with it? Do you love it? Do you hate it? And we've got a questioner here now. Tell us who you are and where you're from.
I'm AJ Scamp from Tallulah, Louisiana, and I have a question about work and the family. How do you believe work is affecting this concept of a traditional family? Should we restructure work to seek the concept, or should we avoid traditional family situations because they're sexually unbalanced?
Ooh. Now, that's a question for you. You're the expert.
Deep question. Must be for Al.
Yeah. Well, that's the best part of being the guest. You get them all right. There are some really telling issues right now. 61% of the workforce is made up of double-income couples. And in fact, about 70% of the double-income couples have children, so you've got this immediate problem. A New York Family Institute suggested a double-income couple with two kids, both adults in that couple, put in 16.5 hours a day of work, commuting, chores, and kids. Last time I looked, that leaves 7.5 hours left in the day for recreation, sleep, et cetera, et cetera. The only thing that schedule guarantees is there won't be a third child. Fatigue makes fools and cowards of us all. And I think what's happened is we've restructured how We look at work. 89% of the women in front of me right now think of themselves as careerists. They want a career and a job. They may want a family. They may want a husband. They may want a family. They may want to do other things. But they want a job that helps support themselves. This puts another dynamic in the workforce. The other factor is, and let's not deny this, women are now the simple majority of the workforce. And by the way, please take it over. It's yours. And in reality, that changes who works and how we work. One other little statistic.
I want to ask how this all impacts of how we think about who we are, right, and what we are, and what our lives are for.
Yeah.
It's fatigue, running yourself ragged, leaving no time for your children, for hobbies. I mean, who could choose to live like that? Yet we choose to live that. Yeah. Is that because that's how we really want to live, or is this situation forced on us by economic necessity or something, and therefore alienating us from what we would like to be? What do you think about that?
You never want to evoke Marx in a concept in a capitalistic context, but I think Marx is right here. There's an alienation effect here. The job itself alienates ourselves from ourselves. The hours, the requirements, the realities of children have changed. How we live, where your parents used to live. When I was growing up, I never had a babysitter. My babysitter was called Grandma, right? And this is an entirely different reality.
But these students are in a hopeful phase of their lives.
Yes.
They don't want to hear that they're going to go through. They don't want to hear that they're going to go through life alienated from themselves, working for the man, never having any deep self-satisfaction. Are you giving them a really bleak message?
I am giving them a bleak message because I want them to be scared. I mean, it used to be we brought out a dead bunny, but we've been smoking cigarettes. And here's their lungs. But I want to suggest to you, so don't let this happen to you, children, you know. And we all ran out and bought cigarettes immediately. But I want to suggest to you that when we put that kind of time in, we've forgotten the purpose of work. I think Aristotle is right. The purpose of work is the attainment of leisure. And we've forgotten that the real purpose of work is to give us time for ourselves.
Yeah, but
give us time
but
for our family.
It's fine to say we've forgotten it, but one steps into a social structure that pre-exists.
That's,
I mean, if you're interested in being a lawyer, you like that kind of work, you find it meaningful, that's all fine. But your first job is probably going to be with a corporation or a firm that absolutely runs you ragged, whatever your personal values are.
I'd like to invite the listener, our live studio audience, to join in this discussion. What do you think about work? Do you find it satisfying, alienating? And we've got a questioner here now.
My name is Jacob Bates from Marshall, Texas, and you were discussing about separating your career and what you love. And I once heard that if you find a career that you love, you will never work a day your entire life. Do you think that holds any value at all?
Yeah, that sounds like it has value to me. So that's going to work. If you really love your work and identify with your work, it's more like play. It's more like freedom.
Right.
Exercise of what you want to
John
do.
John Dewey said, lucky the man who finds pleasure in their work, for now it becomes play. And I think there's always an element to that. But it's also a lie.
There's an element of truth, but it's basically wrong. I mean, I love my job. I don't think you could have a better job than being a philosophy professor at Stanford University. You get to think about what you want to think about. The students are good. The university's beautiful. The administration is even mostly reasonably.
And you love your chairman.
And you love your chairman. We have a really nice chairman who just makes our life easy. But still, a large part of the day is spent committee work, grading papers, talking with students that are not grasping your insights as quickly as they might. So it's not quite the same as play.
Right.
I'm sure glad I've got a job I more or less enjoy. But there's another dimension here. You may or may not enjoy the actual doing of your job, but I think what would really be stifling and awful is if you didn't think your job was something that itself was of value. I think I could be happy being a ditch digger if I was digging, say, graves, and I knew this was an essential function
that had to be done.
But if I was working for the WPA back in the 30s and digging ditches for somebody else to come and fill up, that would be very frustrating.
Right. I also want to suggest that this gentleman has brought up a really important point. What I'm trying to say is there's always labor even in that which you love. And if you're an athlete, a triathlon runner, you know, this is really work. You're already extending yourself. You're almost breaking your body and you're extending your will. It isn't that it's without labor, but it's labor you're willing to do because there's meaning in it. And so, therefore, you're willing to expend
the
time.
We've got some questions on the other side of the room. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. What's your comment or question? Who are you?
I'm Lauren Savage from Marrero, Louisiana. And I was wondering, do you think we choose our job or do you think it's chosen for us since we can't expose what we're exposed to as a child?
I think it's a very fortunate person who gets to choose utterly freely what they're going to do and what they're going to invest their lives. You know, I mean, a lot of people around the world do back backbreaking, drudgery, monotonous work. I read somewhere 1.6 billion people work for poverty wages around
less
the world.
Less than a dollar.
Yeah, less than a dollar, US dollar a day. So a lot of people don't get to choose their work.
Right.
But, you know, we upper middle class.
But in upper middle class society such as ourselves, you get options. And you prepare yourself for options. Let's say you're a theater person, and you take theater, and then you take advanced fine arts, and so on and so forth. You're ready for that role, but you're not cast, and you find something else. What we do is we set ourselves up for some possibilities. But when push comes to shove in regard to work, you either get to do what you like, what you want, or you get to do what you have to do. But we have more options in the world. My grandfather said, and I miss him immensely, he says, job satisfaction. Hey, you should be satisfied you got a job. But this was, and he said it in Italian, which was much better, but this was a post-depression mentality that said any job is better than no job at all. And there was meaning in that job, even filling up that hole, because it was better than no job at all and not being able to take care of your family.
You know, one of the ways, I mean, when you talk about do you choose your job, choices come at different stages.
Right.
One of the most important things in having free choice is being able to envisage lots of possibilities,
right.
Lots of roles that you could play as a human being in life. And that's where a lot of people, even though they're economically well off, don't really have as big a choice as they might think, because their imagination lots of kids come to college with kind of already decided amongst the various roles that have been played by members of their family or people they know, and there's so much other things you could do.
Right.
So it's really important to explore and before making a decision.
See, let me interject one point. Go back to something that John mentioned at the very top of the show, the idea of a calling. Now, I do think that some people are called by some inner voice to do this, to be an actor, to be a violinist, to be a philosopher, to be an entrepreneur. And sometimes they won't listen to that inner voice because there are all these expectations thrown over you. And sometimes listening to that inner voice is fraught with danger because be an actor. Okay, you're going to be an actor. You're going to go to Broadway. Yeah, right. I mean, you may not. And there are a lot of risk in there. And for people the age of many of our audience, I think you, here's a bit of advice. You should learn to listen to that inner voice that calls
Absolutely.
You to try
and
things,
try
to
now.
Take chances. Right.
And try it now. And let me give another piece of advice. When you graduate from here, and I was told by the dean that many of you might, anyway, not all of you, though, graduate from here, and you get a job, and you don't like it, quit. Do something else. I mean, you're going to do dental hygiene. You didn't like it. Do something else, because now you have the option to try. You won't when you have Billy, Mary, and a mortgage.
Yeah.
Do it now.
Let's take some more questions from our live audience. This gentleman over here, what's your name and what's your comment or question?
My name is Diego Martin. I'm from Puerto Rico. And my question is it possible for somebody to get a job that really fulfills them over a job that gives them the economic... the economic comfortableness, you know, like if I like to be a philosopher, but like I need the money, so I'll choose to be a scrum doctor, you know, like and nowadays, like what do you think about that?
Well, you may be faced with a choice where you really can't do what you want and make a living at it, but don't take that answer easily. Don't take it lying down. You may not need as much money as you think. And you may be able to be a little more creative about what you do. So yeah, but sometimes you're just faced with that choice.
Now, how do we raise people? You know, we educate and train people as used to envision themselves relative
right.
to work.
Right.
How do we do that? Do we do a good job or a bad
I
job?
I think we do a very bad job. I remember being a young professor, it's so long ago I could barely recall, but I do have a picture. And a young gentleman came in to me after midterm and says, "You're ruining my medical career. You gave me a B on the midterm." And he was 17 years old, and I thought something was wrong with that. To be 17 years old and to be absolutely preordained, the only thing I want to do is, in fact, be a doctor. Having said that, it's on the one spectrum. I don't think just because you have a major, that's necessarily what you're going to do in life. Yes, your parents want you to have some connection between your major and a job possibility. That's why parents get a little upset when you say, "I'm majoring in, you know, Slovakian poetry or Slovakian poetry," because how many jobs are out there? But I don't think we prepare them. I think that part of the training in school should be job talks, should be career talks, not just those silly things you talked about in high school or in grammar school when you had your parents come in, but talk about vocational options, how you want to spend your time, your mind, and your life.
So let's take some more questions on this side of the room. Well, what's your comment or question, and tell us who you are.
I'm Jacob Jones from Bedford, Texas, and y'all have talked a lot about jobs being fulfilling and valuable. I'm wondering what makes a job fulfilling or valuable for people. Is it desire for self-satisfaction or to please God or some authority figure or religious statutes or make life better for someone?
That's a really good question. Yeah. I mean, I'm going to take a stab because I think it's only a question that you can ask for yourself. And I think I also think it's a question you should be deeply, deeply alive to. Because here's the thing. I came up with this ratio the other day. The ratio of the time it takes, the proportion of your total time that devotion to your job will take, and the proportion of your total self that that job is worth. Yeah. Right? If those ratios are equal, if the time it takes is proportioned to the worth that that job has for yourself and your self-configuration, then it's a great situation. But if it's not, it's not a great situation. Now, I don't know how you decide. You have to decide for yourself.
It is always subjective, but there are some road barriers here. First of all, do you like what you're doing? Because I have met people who have been professional baseball players, didn't want to be a professional baseball player, but they were doing that, believe it or not. Do you do it well? Because the most frustrating people in the world I know are people who have jobs maybe they've always wanted, but they're not successful at it. To use another baseball metaphor, the chap in Bull Durham, right? Here he was, he wanted to make the bigs, he made the bigs, and in point of fact, he wasn't good enough to stay in the bigs, right? And then you can't do too much of it because it wears us out. George C. Scott said once, you can't do a matinee and two supper shows 7 days a week and have anything to offer anymore, you know, in that performance. So I think it's talent for it, enjoy it, have some success in it, and don't kill yourself in the process.
And I'm going to add, there's one more thing. It's got to, I said it's up to you, but I didn't really mean that. It's got to be at least morally worthy for a human being to do.
Yes.
You want to do work that is worth a human being doing.
Absolutely. If you think you have a vocation, if you think you have a calling, make sure who's calling to you, whose voice and what they're saying. Make sure it's not just your parents' desires echoing in your mind and coming back. I used to think I had a calling to play football, but apparently what it was calling to me wasn't come play, but go away.
And it called pretty loudly after a while, as I understand.
I had that same muse,
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing work with Al Genie.
We've talked about how work can become part of a person's identity, for better or for worse. We're going to continue on these themes, asking what's the right balance between work and the other parts of one's life.
We're coming to you from Centenary College in Shreveport, Louisiana. We'll answer more questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Philosophy may not be a 9-to-5 job, but it can still be hard work. I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing work with Al Genie. Now, Al, I want to ask you a question. We Americans are conditioned to work really hard.
Absolutely.
We worship work. We don't like people who don't work.
Absolutely.
Now, you might say that, so we're workaholics.
Yep.
You know. Now, I want to ask you, is that a good thing or a bad thing? I mean, you might think it's a good thing because you might think leisure, that's just a bourgeois term for not working, and that's bad.
No, not at all. You got a little backup on this. I mean, our four founders, you know, we came to this country for an opportunity, and we came here, and to survive, we literally had to work hard. So the work ethic isn't the Protestant work ethic. It's the immigrant work ethic, whether it's the Jewish work ethic or the Italian or the Pole and so on and so forth. We came here for opportunità. And so we had that opportunity. And then, in this century, you had the Depression. So jobs became critical, things we wanted to have. And then we put in the hours and hours and hours. Here's my problem. It's not working hard because anyone who's a success has to put in huge hours, whether you like it or not. You can't be a brain surgeon on Mondays and Wednesdays. And Tuesdays, I'm doing pottery. And on Thursdays, I'm doing cookies down at the mall. You know, that's not how it happens. And then the other factor is, though, that work becomes an addiction. We get lost in the work. We get taken up by the work. And then there are economic considerations. That's what I'm against.
But let me look at the other side of it. So my father worked in the factory all his life. He worked overtime. He worked 7 days a week. He worked really hard at a job he did not love. But what he loved and what made him proud is his persistent and never abandoning station, as it were. He worked hard. And he took that to be a virtue, just working really hard, even at an utterly drudgery-inducing
job.
And
so your father actually mirrored exactly what Abraham Lincoln said. My father taught me that I must work hard, but I need not love my work. And so many of us are caught in jobs we don't like. But there is dignity in doing the job. And that's part of it. I'm talking about a workaholic who is doing that job because they don't want to deal with life, because they're excessive consumerholics, that kind of thing. So, no, workaholism isn't because I'm afraid of play. In fact, can we go play right now?
Yeah, well, let's let our audience play into this play on this side of the room. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. Who are you and what's your comment or question?
I'm Rachel DeLoach from Minden, Louisiana. And you said something earlier about how more women are in the workforce now than men. And I was wondering if you think that's happening because women feel as if they have more of a freedom to have a career, or that they feel they're going to be looked down upon if they're a stay-at-home mom.
Oh, what do you think?
Wow,
that's a good one.
That was really an issue about 20 years ago in the stay-at-homes and night-stay-at-home moms. Since whatever you want to call the feminist revolution in some sense, the women in the workplace, when I went to college, 70% of the women that I graduated from high school, 83% of the women that I graduated from high school did not go to college because it wasn't expected in middle-class families for that to be natural. Now, in point of fact, universities around America, 62% of the undergraduate population is women. Women are also the simple majority in the nation right now, unless I have my statistics incorrect. I teach in the school of business, but I'm still a philosopher, so I'm a little fuzzy with the numbers right now. And the reality is women have permission to have careers. That's no longer a debate. And women recognize that you don't sit around. No woman in this room says, I'm going to graduate from high school and just eat bonbons until I meet Mr. Wright and get married, right? That doesn't
happen.
Is that
right? Did anybody say that here?
No one will admit that. And men, too. Men have never had that option. No man said, I don't know, Bill, what are you going to do when you graduate? I don't know, kind of just hang around.
Let's add something to this, though. Yeah. I mean, this is a really complicated thing, women in the workforce. Because one of the reasons there are more women in the workforce is that not just that women flood the workforce because they want to in liberation, men are disappearing from the workforce. And part of that is because the jobs that men used to do largely exclusively they're disappeared.
Absolutely.
They're going elsewhere. And you know, you look in the prisons, we have many men in prison. So take those out of the workforce, but you take those out of the population, and who's going to do the work?
Well, one reason so many women work is because it takes two incomes to make a middle-class living these days. And, you know, you might have thought, well, this is great. Women will be free to work. They'll be empowered to work. But it really will only take one income to support a family. So some men will not have to work. Well, maybe they'll pursue other things.
Well, some
didn't work that way at all. It's one of the last one-income families in America. Well, let me tell you, it doesn't work that way.
And there's also this. There are a lot of single mothers out there working themselves to the bone.
Two and three jobs.
Working themselves.
Let's look at whatever normal is, where philosophers will have a big range on that right now. But a couple graduate from college right now. 89% of homes sold are sold to double-income families. And in point of fact, the mortgage companies look at both of your mortgages. When I bought my first home, and I think at least one gentleman at this table, one of us is very young and two of us are not, we'll leave that to you to decide, we couldn't list our wives as workers for that mortgage. You had to be able to pay that mortgage on your own. And what we're suggesting now is it takes one whole salary to pay the mortgage on the home and the mortgage on the car. So we need each other, and so therefore women are needed in the workplace.
Let's take some more questions from our live studio audience in this
Great
side
question.
Of the room.
I'm Peyton Davis from Houston, Texas. If you believe that our identity is partially defined by our jobs, do you believe that our identity is just a persona if we don't enjoy what we do?
Oh, yes. In fact, here's the terrible news. If your identity is tied to your job and you're in a job you don't like, you're not going to be a very happy person. Because if you do that much, it ruins your sense of self. In a job that is degrading and doesn't allow for mobility, doesn't allow for options, so on and so forth. I think when you're unhappy with your work, it's the poison that poisons the rest of the well.
Think of it this way. Either your work is going to become a welcome part of yourself, You say, ha, that's part of me. Or it's going to make an assault on yourself,
that's
and
right.
you're going to have to ward it off. But it's such a big deal. It's not going to leave the self alone. Either it's going to configure as part of it, or it's going to be like right. this alien interloper.
Right. No one can say of 60 hours a week, how was your week? Not bad. I didn't pay attention. How can you not pay attention to 60 hours of your conscious week?
So let's on this side of the room. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
My name's Colin from St. Francisville, Louisiana. I actually had a comment on the idea of your work and your identity, your social identity. I was just going to say, it seems to me like, you know, when you introduce yourself to new people, when you meet new people, a lot of times the first or second question you ask is, what do you do? And so is there maybe a double standard that some people, they don't see themselves as being their work and they see others? And then also I wanted to ask Al, we were talking about earlier about how Americans had this hard work drive. Is it similar in other countries? Other countries, they have more vacation mm-hmm. time, they work less hours. What are the views on work in other countries besides our own?
I think part of it is social convention. But again, in my age group, when a group of men were at a smoker, which is no longer politically correct, or having drinks, first thing you ask is name, rank, and serial number. What's your name? What do you do? Where do you work? And you know, where do you live? And you never got to children. Are you married? Do you have children? What are your hobbies? Long time later. Because my friend the lawyer may be more interested than my friend the plumber, even though the plumber probably makes a little bit more money, but that's a discussion for another time. And I think that's part of the social convention. It doesn't happen in Europe. In fact, it's considered rude. In France and Italy, say, che cosa fai? What do you mean, what are you doing? And he said, what do you mean, what am I doing right now? It's kind of rude. You're supposed to meet and greet people as they are in the moment you are. I think, and the larger question, is it just America? No, I don't know if the rest of the panel agrees. I think America has westernized the whole world. I think Europe is America East or West, yeah. depending on what direction you're looking at, et cetera.
They have more paid holidays, though.
You do have more paid holidays.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about work with Al Dini from Loyola University of Chicago, and we've got more questions from our live studio audience.
My name is Carolyn Lucas. I'm from Petal, Mississippi. You guys mentioned earlier that women make up the majority of the workforce. What do you think are some causes of the wage inequalities between men and women? Do you think it's a matter of workplace discrimination, or is it an encouragement of traditional family roles?
That's such a great and important question, because I can't figure it out. It's like apartheid. How is it that you're the simple majority of the workforce and yet don't have the money? And after studying this a long time, and I'm interested to hear what you guys have to say, it's power. It may be that the clique of white males at the top or the clique of males at the top, remember, you got to look at who's the CEOs, too, and who's on the boards. The minority is still the women. It may be that 62% of your workforce is women, just to throw out a number. But in point of fact, less than 7% are in the executive directors of your organization. So it's about power. I don't think it's about men hating women. I don't think it's about men keeping women down. Certainly not for your generation. Maybe for ours.
I think I agree with you, but I think it's very complicated. But
yeah.
the dynamics of our lives in a lot of ways, and it's a kind of a bargaining kind
right.
of, if you look at it this way. My wife is a librarian, okay? And there aren't very many male librarians, but the ones there are much more likely to be directors of libraries. So the most well-paid positions in the library science field go disproportionately to men. Now, you might think, why is that? Well, it's not you might think, well, it's discrimination or something like that. That may be part of it, but that's too simple, because the overwhelming majority of librarians are women. Now, why is that? Why is it that I think it might be something like this, the arc of a life.
Right.
Women want to have children. Men don't participate as much in child rearing and all that stuff. Don't stop out their careers. And in these high-powered professions, the way to become the CEO or the dean or the director is to never stop.
That's right.
Is to never, ever, ever stop.
I think it's all the things you mentioned. But I do think that in today's world, if a woman wants to earn a lot of money and wants to be a CEO and is willing to take a hard look at the sacrifices that requires, it's in the cards. I don't think there's the kind of prejudice there was or structural limits there was when I was growing up. I think it's possible, but it still requires grit, determination, and hard choices.
Let me suggest one other thing. To get there, though, you got to play hardball more than the guys. There's a great article in Harvard Business Review called The Only Bra in the Room, where the only woman there, you know, but she got to the top not by being, you know, misrelational and not by bringing cookies and cakes. It's by being the toughest woman there. And ladies, let me give you a little warning. to work for that woman, don't expect her to help you either. She made it to the top on her own. She's not going to reach back for you.
We've got time for one last questioner right over there.
Hi, I'm Megan from Freeport, Louisiana. Well, it's a part of our identity, but what happens when we lose our job? Does that mean our identity is lost and we have no idea who we are? Is work really a part of our self-development?
Yeah, that's a great question. What happens when we lose our jobs? Well, I can't answer it at your age group because I think your age group is not going to be as invested. But, you know, picture the 80s again when everybody was getting laid off in the early 90s. What do you do when you're 48 years old, two kids in college, two cars in the driveway, a mortgage past your eyeballs, and you just lost a job you've had for 25 years and have no other cross training?
Yeah.
I think you're really challenged as a person in regard to your identity, your worth, and your options.
I think your generation, you know, there was a time when the people who faced this, their manufacturing jobs were moving all over the place and all this. I think now any job, any job almost, is in danger of being outsourced, moved away. And your generation will unfortunately face a lot of self-reconfiguration over the course of your working life. Don't you agree with that?
Almost any job except being a tenured philosophy professor.
Thank God for that. But I think he's right. I mean, Robert Reich said it right. It used to be that you had three jobs in one career. Now you may have 15 jobs and three different careers in a lifetime. And so part of your job is to be open to the process of change. And I hate to quote Leo Bascaglia on a stage with so many revered academics, but if you don't like change, you're not going to enjoy life much at all.
On that note, I'm going to have to thank you for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me here.
Our guest has been Al Dini. He's professor of business ethics. He's professor of business ethics at Loyola University of Chicago. He's author of My Job, Myself, Work, and the Creation of the Modern Individual, and he's resident philosopher at Chicago Public Radio. Thanks for joining us so much. So, John, Al is a wise man, and we had lots of great questions from our students in the audience here. What did you learn today from all this?
Well, today, and in preparation for this show, when I read Al's book on I forget the title, it says about relaxation
His second book.
Anyway, he's got a whole slug of books, and they're all good reads. They're just the right lengths to read on the plane. Full of good ideas, and they're not straight philosophical books. They've got some sociology, some statistics. Maybe as a philosopher he made it up, I don't know. But anyway, really good stuff. Learned a lot about work. As so often in life, I am reminded how lucky I am and you are to be a tenured philosophy professor with a lot of job security and a very pleasant job. I got a little discouraged about the difficulties of having a society that provides everybody with meaningful work and meaningful leisure. It's not so easy to come by.
No, that's a kind of Marxist utopian ideal that everybody could labor meaningfully and not be alienated from their work. And it would be really grand. But I think as the world is currently organized and as economies are currently organized, I think making work meaningful is a deep challenge because this thing we said at the end about how jobs can be wiped away. If you identify with that job and it's wiped away, is yourself gone? I mean, and jobs are big and demanding these days. I mean, people work and they work and they work. And the question is that work, the time it takes to do that work, proportional to the part of itself, yourself, that job is worth being? I think it's really hard. But, you know, this conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore I blog.
You can download podcasts of our program from our website as well. We want to thank everyone in our live audience for participating in our program today. Give yourselves a round of applause. Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2007.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Special thanks to Ken Aizawa, Chris Cicchetti, Michelle Glaros, Michael Laffey and the Attaway Fellows Program at Centenary College in Shreveport. Also thanks to Devin Strolovich and David Bruce.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and from Powell City of Books. Support also comes from the Templeton Foundation.
Also from the members of KALW, KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders, even if they should.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.